Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the deaths of four American soldiers and intelligence contractors in the tense and volatile town of Manbij in northern Syria, which ISIS took credit for, just as Vice President Pence was declaring, quote, "the caliphate has crumbled and ISIS has been defeated." David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, who was a foreign affairs advisor to the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations, and author of The Great Betrayal, How America Betrayed the Kurds and Lost the Middle East, joins us. We'll discuss the role of Turkey, who, under an agreement with Trump, have a presence in Manbij, which was liberated from ISIS by American-backed Syrian Kurdish forces, but also has Syrian Arab rebels backed by Turkey nearby, who the Kurds consider terrorists, while Turkey considers the Kurds terrorists. With Erdogan blaming the suicide bombing on the Kurds, we'll explore the need for a full inquiry into who was behind the bombing, since it could have been ISIS or even Turkey, and assess the impact of Senator Lindsey Graham's criticism of the incoherent Trump foreign policy in Syria, which he complained is emboldening ISIS while undermining America's ally, the Syrian Kurds. Then, with the new Speaker of the House essentially telling Trump he is not welcome in her house to deliver the State of the Union as long as he has the government shut down, we will speak with James Thurber, the University Distinguished Professor of Government and founder and former director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. He joins us to discuss how Nancy Pelosi is not dealing with a normal situation and with a normal president, and with a normal president who deals with facts and is someone you can make a deal with. So, while having Trump deliver the State of the Union from a bunker in the White House is not normal, why pretend Trump is normal and these are normal times? Then finally, with revelations emerging from the trial in Manhattan of the Mexican drug lord El Chapo, that the former president of Mexico, Peña Nieto, asked for a $250 million bribe and settled for a $100 million bribe, we will speak with Mexico City-based reporter Joan Grillo, the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, and Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. We will discuss why the Mexican press is playing down this unsurprising but explosive story. And joining us now is David Phillips, the director of Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. Handy is the author of An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship, and his latest book is The Great Betrayal, How America Betrayed the Kurds and Lost the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And today is an extraordinary day in terms of looking at the news, David, where you see the Vice President of the United States making a speech saying that the Islamic State is basically finished and we'll be bringing the troops home. And then shortly thereafter, or if not at the same time, we learn that American soldiers have been killed in northern Syria near the Turkish border. So what a contrast. I mean, who's minding the store in terms of our foreign policy? It just feels to me like, and when you get people like Lindsey Graham, you know, breaking out of a hearing for the new Attorney General, basically saying that essentially the signals coming from our leadership, from the White House, are basically emboldening the Islamic State and disheartening our Kurdish allies.
So I was just in northern Syria about 3 weeks ago. It's an extremely volatile part of Syria. The idea that the Islamic State has been destroyed and that we can fold our tent and bring our troops home is far-fetched. The fact that Mike Pence is making a speech heralding the defeat of ISIS at the same time as a suicide bomber is blowing up U.S. soldiers in Manbij just shows how deeply disassociated from reality the Trump administration is. If we withdraw from Syria, ISIS will come back. Our Kurdish allies will be slaughtered. Turkey will move in. the country will fragment. The administration has no sense, no coherent policy when it comes to Iraq or Syria. And after years of fighting and trillions of dollars and many lives lost, we can do better.
And what do you make of that Turkish President Erdogan saying, essentially implying that this suicide bombing was a provocation by the Kurds killing Americans in order to get America to stay with them? That pretty much is what between the lines of what he said.
So that's a total fiasco, what he said. If anything, the perpetrators were jihadists that are sponsored by Turkey, associated with the Free Syrian Army, which is a branch of al-Qaeda in Syria. Until there's a full investigation into the incident, we really don't know. But I'm not surprised that Turkey's President Erdogan has jumped all over the incident and is trying to manipulate it for his own political purposes.
So tell us about this town of Manjib. My understanding is that the U.S. contractors, I think they were, intelligence contractors, with a couple of American soldiers as sort of, you know, escorts or bodyguards, met in a restaurant with members of the local military council, who I assume were Kurds. But there's still a lot of Arabs in this town, and it's been under the occupation of the Islamic State for a number of years. So what do you think happened there?
So Manbij has a local council, which includes all northerners in Syria, Arabs, Yazidis, Christians, and Kurds. They also have a military council, which has been responsible for providing security to the local population. Turkey has insisted that it wants to take over the security operation. And the Trump administration agreed to joint patrols with Turkey. It hasn't made the town more safe. It's made it more insecure. It's just an example of how we don't have a coherent security strategy. And by inviting Turkey to participate as a security partner, we make our allies more vulnerable, not less. It's time to rethink our approach, get back to basics, and to work with our partners, with whom we've cooperated closely to defeat the Islamic State and drive them back, not to invite Turkey and its jihadist allies to come in.
So that would indicate, because Turkey has boots on the ground and has its own agenda, and it's not unlikely that Turkey could have a hand in this, is it? Because if we've made some kind of deal with them to sort of monitor what's going on, and we know that Erdogan and the Turkish military wanted just, you know, permission to go out and kill all the Kurds, it's got to be a very, very unstable town, isn't it, Manjib? It's a pretty dangerous place for
it. Extremely unstable and volatile place.
Uh-huh.
The bottom line is we have no idea who the perpetrators were. It is possible that Turkey was behind the incident. They know that Trump gets cold feet, and they may be trying to drive him out or accelerate America's departure. The fact that they were so quick to claim that it was the Kurds responsible for the incident as a way of bringing America's exit forward really raises red flags for me. We need a full investigation to find out who was the suicide bomber, where did he get his equipment, and where did he take his orders from.
And again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, the director of the Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's the former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. He's also the author of An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship, and his latest book is The Great Betrayal, How America Betrayed the Kurds and Lost the Middle East. So we know that the announcement for the U.S. to withdraw that came out of the blue from Trump without consulting allies and without consulting any of his national security advisors, which was so upsetting to the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, that he quit. That all was precipitated by a phone conversation that Trump had with Erdogan. Apparently, Trump had been counseled by his chief of staff, Kelly, and by Mattis ahead of the conversation. They basically gave him the talking points. And then, for whatever reason, Trump was completely swayed by Erdogan and totally ignored the talking points, and then made this agreement with Erdogan that he would pull out of Syria, that the Americans would pull out of Syria, pull the 2,000 troops out, and that somehow Turkey would guarantee stability and continue the fight against the Islamic State. There's also some reports that in the course of that conversation, maybe Trump got Erdogan to back off MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, and give him some wiggle room, get him out from under the obvious complicity or responsibility for the murder of Khashoggi in Istanbul. So that's still a very, very important moment, is it not? It hasn't really been investigated. What do you think's going on?
It's also possible that they talked about Russia's sale of S-400 surface-to-air missiles to Turkey.
Right.
Trump has been trying to get Turkey to switch the purchase terms and buy Patriot missiles instead. And we know this is a president who does national security policy based on what military equipment can be sold and what earnings can be garnered. So there were probably several items that were a part of the conversation. But the idea that Erdogan tells Trump, you leave Syria, we'll come in and destroy ISIS for you, and that Trump immediately agrees and says, Syria, it's yours. What is going on here? What kind of president conducts international security so spontaneously without consulting his national security team, without having a coherent plan? Trump said, we will withdraw immediately and completely. You just don't pull 2,200 troops out overnight. There's all the equipment. There are the security arrangements. There are the other allies, not only the Kurds, but international partners, British and French, that are on the ground. The whole thing is totally far-fetched. It makes the United States look stupid.
Well, how much has it been reversed, though? Bolton went to the neighborhood and said it's not going to happen, or it's going to happen very slowly. And we know that Netanyahu weighed in. He was alarmed by what happened. Where do we stand? Do we really know now? And Pompeo then seemed to contradict Bolton. So what's our understanding? Because this is what Lindsey Graham, and I'm no great fan of Lindsey Graham, because he's turned out to be such a toady in terms of defending Trump. But Lindsey Graham obviously went out of his way in a hearing today, the second day of the hearing for the Attorney General William Barr, where he said basically the Trump administration is signaling to ISIS, emboldening them, I think is the word that he used. At the same time, he's confusing and demoralizing our Kurdish allies. That seems to be pretty clear. So what do you understand is our policy here? Do you have any idea, David?
So we don't have a policy, and I have no understanding about what our intentions are. The last I heard, Trump said that we wanted to establish a security buffer in northern Syria, 25 miles deep, and that Turkey would provide the security. Over the weekend, when John Bolton was in Israel, he talked about conditions for the U.S. withdrawal. That ISIS is destroyed, and that Turkey provides security guarantees to our Kurdish allies. So from day to day, the policy is changing. We really don't know what is the official policy of the United States government. We did see 11 vehicles leaving northern Syria over the past couple of days with equipment, although apparently no troops left. So it is not apparent what we're doing or where we're going. It's no way to run a war.
So what substitutes, though, could there be? You say the French and the British are there. If the U.S. goes ahead and pulls out and exposes the Kurds to a slaughter by Erdogan, is there anything that can stop them? I mean, what do you think Netanyahu said to him? Because it's very, I think, instructive that just recently the Israelis made public the extent of their covert war, or their proxy war, if you will, inside Syria against Iran, where they pointed out how many targets they'd struck and how this is a much, much deeper war, and that every time the IRGC or the Quds try and put some equipment or a man in there, the Israelis pound them. So,
Ian, if we want to withdraw from Syria, we can pull the troops out.
Uh-huh.
The Kurdish fighters in the north are capable of defending themselves if they're just dealing with a ground force. Uh-huh. Where they are at risk is when it comes to Turkey's air power. So we could pull out the troops. We could do that in 3 or 4 months. At the same time, we could announce a no-fly zone, preventing Turkish planes from attacking our allies on the ground. That would give the United States the opportunity to achieve its goals by withdrawing the forces. Trump can cater to his base. He made the pledge. It would also protect the Kurds, who are our allies and who are largely responsible for defeating ISIS. What's not tenable is for us to withdraw, to cut and run, and leave our partners at the mercy of Turkish mercenaries who will slaughter them, behead them, rape their women, and mutilate their bodies. So the United States needs to have a position. It needs to be driven by a strategy. To cut and run and abandon our friends is not a credible policy. It just sends a message worldwide that the U.S. can't be counted upon.
But just in closing, though, what hold does Erdogan have over Trump? Because it doesn't make any sense, going back to his original conversation from which he decided to pull out the American troops. And then you've got this crazy situation where Erdogan now wants to arrest a popular basketball player here in the United States, an NBA player. I mean, you know, isn't it pretty obvious that this guy is not somebody that we should be dealing with, or at least making deals with?
So that's certainly true. And when we talk about the American basketball player, Enes Kanter, he's not worried about being arrested. He's worried about being assassinated by Turkish intelligence agents around the world. So why are we doing business with Erdogan? And why is Turkey still a member of NATO when they constantly are stabbing us in the back and undermining NATO principles through their gross violation of human rights? Erdogan and Trump are cut from the same cloth, as are other authoritarian populist dictators. The American people should hold Trump to account and demand an explanation as to why we're in bed with people like Erdogan and Putin and others who clearly are acting against U.S. national interests.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, thanks a lot. Always a pleasure to be on the show with you.
And I've been speaking with David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq, Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And he's also the author of An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship. And his latest book is The Great Betrayal, How America Betrayed the Kurds and Lost the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي يواسيني
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Thurber, the University Distinguished Professor of Government and founder and former director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. He is the author of numerous books and more than 80 articles and chapters on Congress, interest groups, and lobbying, and campaigns and elections. And his latest book is Congress and Diaspora Politics, The Influence of Ethnic and Foreign Lobbying. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Thurber.
It's good to be here, Ian. Thank you.
And you're a longtime student of American politics and been there at the belly of the beast, if you will, in Washington. Have you ever seen anything like this? Here we have a situation where the new Speaker of the House is basically saying to the president, you're not welcome in my house until you open up the government. I mean, on the surface, she's saying that we have security concerns about you delivering your State of the Union address, and we would therefore like you to either not show up or send it in writing. But I'm pretty sure what the real message here is, you're not welcome in my house.
Well, it's unique. It's unique in terms of the history of the shutdown in the middle of this confrontation. But I think she's expressing the power given to Congress in Article 1 of the Constitution. She has the right, and she's used to invite or disinvite the President of the United States. He may give that address from his bunker in the White House, but he is not invited to go to the Hill until they resolve this issue of the shutdown. She's using the statement that she's worried about security because many of the people that are associated with giving security Secret Service, but others are not being paid, and she thinks it's inappropriate.
So is there more to this, though, in the sense that we've heard, she's never said it quite bluntly, but more or less what she's been saying about these meetings that they've had. And as you know, James Thurber, the president invited a number of Democratic Congress people he thought he might be able to peel off for a meeting in the White House, and they refused to show up. It seems that the tactic on the part of Pelosi now is to try and ignore him. But what she's made clear from previous meetings is that it's awfully difficult meeting with a president who does not have a kind of a basic understanding of the facts. He has his own facts. And together with the fact that if you do make a deal with him, no sooner are you out of the Oval Office, he's likely to renege on the deal because he gets influenced by something he sees on Fox News or listens to from Rush Limbaugh. So is that what's really going on behind the scenes here? The sense that, I mean, apart from politics and apart from political posturing, is it possible that Pelosi and Schumer have really decided that this guy's not fit for office and you can't deal with him?
Well, I think this is unique in the history of the United States that he has shown that he cannot be trusted. He makes up facts. And when you're negotiating with somebody, especially on the importance of all of the functions of government that people on the left, the right, the middle need, then you have to stand up to him. And you have to use the rule of law, Constitution, and your abilities to force him to come to the table and make a decision. He doesn't really understand negotiation related to government. Maybe he understands negotiation when he's bankrupt and he has a housing project and he wants to renegotiate loans and things, but this is not what we have. He's using that same tactic that he did in business, walking away like a child sometimes, from the deal. Now, the only way that Pelosi and Schumer, but others behind the scenes, Republicans behind the scenes, can force him to do this is something like not allowing him to have the State of the Union message to embarrass him. Now that the Democrats are in power in the House of Representatives, they don't have, sorry about this term, but they don't have Republican toadies going along with the president no matter what. I think many of the Republicans now are supporting Pelosi behind the scenes because they really are very concerned about this for their constituents, for the voters that supported them. Again, I say that were based upon a constitution, rule of law, deliberation, honesty, and the president doesn't seem to be concerned about those things.
And I'm speaking with James Thurber, who's the University Distinguished Professor of Government and founder and former director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University in Washington, D.C. He's the author of numerous books and more than 80 articles and chapters on Congress, interest groups, and lobbying and campaign and elections. And his latest book is Congress and Diaspora Politics, The Influence of Ethnic and Foreign Lobbying. Well, the broader issue seems to me is that, and this again is unprecedented, that we have a president who apparently in private is I'm trying to think of the right word without sounding too polemical, because he's apparently just sort of out to lunch, I guess. You know, you recall when...
Unless he's looking at himself in the mirror.
or on television, which is apparently what he does for 8 hours a day. I mean, that would be the equivalent of... If you're an actor, and here I'm talking to you from Hollywood, if you're an actor, you'll be more interested in the reviews than the performance. So that's what we sort of have, this man who's monitoring his own performance, or at least how people are reacting to him, rather than being proactive. That's strange in itself, but all the reporting you get through the cracks indicates that this is truly somebody that's completely out of his depth and unfit to govern. And the upcoming testimony by his fixer, the lawyer Michael Cohen, apparently he's going to tell the American public that Donald Trump is a madman. So is that really, at the end of the day...
Cohen is not the first, if he states this, that the president is infantile and really random and close to being a madman. These are not impeachable things that are going on, but people generally in the Democratic and Republican Party are very concerned about it, about him. And I think that it will continue to get worse and worse, and I don't know where it ends, actually, at this point.
So do you think it inexorably is heading towards the invocation of the 25th Amendment?
Well, some people have certainly talked about his mental state not being right and to use the 25th Amendment to get rid of him. They did at the very beginning of the administration. I don't know if you remember all the discussions then. Mm-hmm. I think there's some evidence that that would be a viable route. I think the Democrats are afraid to use impeachment because they think that it wouldn't go anywhere in the Senate and that it would enhance his popularity and his base as it did with Clinton. But I really strongly believe in the perfection of our governments, the bureaucracy, the rule of law, the Constitution, the state's attorney general, and our government organizations that are continuing to put pressure to get him to stop what he's doing or to push him in another direction. Our democracy is being challenged right now, more so than even during a war, in my opinion. And we don't have this clear external threat to the United States as you do in war, but we have a clear internal threat to our democratic institutions, and I think people understand that, and we will continue to struggle to get through this. And yet, I don't know the end game yet.
Well, one thing has changed, and it certainly hasn't changed for the better, and that is that those few adults in the room, as they're referred to, that were constraining Donald Trump's impulses and trying to educate him about reality, they're no longer there. So he's getting advice now from his son-in-law, Jared, his daughter, Ivanka, his campaign manager, Brad Parcells, and Stephen Miller. So he's not getting any kind of, there's nobody... speaking truth to power anymore. So we're on a more dangerous trajectory, are we not, than we were before when Secretary Mattis. I mean, the fact that we just learned that Donald Trump was literally about to go to the microphones and pull the United States out of NATO, and he was stopped at the last minute by General Mattis, that's just
breathtaking to understand that that almost happened. And I mean, it could happen again. So
yeah, the adults are gone. The adults are gone. The people who brought truth to power are gone. When you have to rely upon Stephen Miller, your colleague from Santa Monica, that still remembers his high school days when he was insulted, and that influences what he suggests to the president, we are in bad shape. Everyone says, well, Ivanka and Jared are limiting what he can do. I don't think so. I don't think they know enough about government. I don't think they know enough about these policies to have a positive impact. It is a problem, and America generally is very worried about it. There are people, quote, that are his base, 30% of America that like what he's doing and ignore his personality and the way he does it.
So short of him having a Howard Beale moment in front of the cameras, Howard Beale being the character from the movie Network that's now a Broadway play.
Yeah, I know.
I was mentioning that for the benefit of the audience, that he may...
No,
he had the famous line, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. But of course, Howard Beale actually made sense. If Donald Trump goes off the deep end, he may not make sense. But short of that happening, what would or could break the spell of that 30% that's kept inside the Fox News bubble where they're immune to facts and evidence?
Well, I think the impact on, especially on farmers and upper tier Midwest, on what the tariffs are doing and whether jobs have been created or not in the coal industry, all of these things eat away at it. But the most important thing right now is that if the Democrats have candidates, plural, or a candidate eventually, that really addresses their needs and addresses how crazy this guy is, in this democracy, that's the way out. And the way out is through an election. And the election campaign has started. And some of the candidates are very careful about criticizing the president. I think that the gloves are going to come off soon, and they're going to directly criticize him. Now, I think they've got to have with that a suggestion how they can improve people's lives, the people's lives that were captured by his populist argument, anti-immigrant populist argument. So again, I go back, I trust our democracy, I trust the campaigns, I trust the House of Representatives to have rigorous oversight hearings. All of these things will add up and put limits on what they can do. What Mueller finds, maybe in terms of Russian investment, the post-2000 crash where he couldn't get money and maybe he got money to help his companies, as that comes out, I think that will continue to change people's minds.
But just in closing, though, in that context, then, it would make sense for Nancy Pelosi to do what she's doing now, because you can't accept this as being normal. And she's more or less signaling here by telling the president that he's not welcome to give the State of the Union until the government is open. Not that she's saying that openly, but essentially, do you think it's the right tactic to more or less say, we can't treat this situation as normal, we can't treat this man, this president, as being normal, the situation is not normal, and therefore the American people have got to wake up and realize that these are not normal times? Do you think, in a broad sense, that's what's happening here in terms of her strategy?
So I think her message is not a partisan, tribal, or polarized message. It is a message that says Article 1 of the Constitution establishes the power of Congress. We have the power to invite or not invite him, and that he is not a normal executive. We do not invite him here, especially when government is shut down. I think that's a clear message. And I think it goes well beyond just party politics at this point. It goes on, it addresses the issue of the power of Congress under the Constitution. And by the way, I'll say it again. She also said, well, he can make a statement from the White House. I say he can make a statement from the bunker in the White House, but that's different than going to Congress and beating up on everybody in Congress for an hour for the American public to see.
Well, James Thurber, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
And this is a documentary.
Pardon?
You ask great questions.
Well, I thank you for joining us.
It's good.
Okay. Well,
yeah, thanks for calling.
I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with James Thurber, the University Distinguished Professor of Government and founder and former director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. He's the author of numerous books and more than 80 articles and chapters on Congress, interest groups, and lobbying and campaigns and elections. And his latest book is Congress and Diaspora Politics, The Influence of Ethnic and Foreign Lobbying.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Joan Grillo, who has reported on Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, Reuters, CNN, the Associated Press, and the PBS NewsHour. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, which was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Books Prize. And his latest book is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Grillo.
Always good to be here.
Well, thanks so much. And you're in Cali, Colombia, as we speak. And there is, of course, a breaking story in Mexico, which the Mexican press, for reasons I don't quite understand, apparently playing down. And that is the explosive revelations coming out of the trial of El Chapo in New York City, where one of his lieutenants has testified that El Chapo paid off Peña Nieto, the former president of Mexico, $100 million. Apparently, Peña Nieto asked for $250 million, but settled on $100 million. You would think that that would be something that the Mexican press would be all over.
Yeah, indeed. Well, quite an international story. Out of New York, actually, the guy testifying was Colombian. So that links to me being here in Colombia. And interesting as well, I'm in Cali, Colombia now. Yesterday I was up in the mountains about an hour and a half away and still seeing enormous amounts of coca leaves being grown for cocaine, which is taken. And obviously this is all to do with cocaine trafficking money. Absolutely a story. I mean, a huge story in a sense, but also an issue that, I mean, first of all, there's no proof beyond this testimony of this confessed drug trafficker. So I think in the trial you've had these various accusations of corruption coming out, and this obviously is the biggest one yet, $100 million to the former president. But are a drug trafficker's words in court enough to convict the guy or to start an investigation even? And that's the kind of question now. Why the press, the Mexican press, you would think it would be the front page. And I think there's a couple of things. One is there's, funnily enough, the present president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has been hesitant to go after corrupt former officials. He said, you know, he said publicly, I don't really go for revenge. I think it will be too destabilizing for the system to go after the ex-president on a focus on trying to fix the country. Obviously, there's a lot of criticism of that. People saying, well, you can't debate justice. If people are guilty, they need to be convicted. And some of the press seems to be kind of falling in line a bit with him and kind of supporting his line. So that could be part of the reason. You know, you have a lot of heavy influence on Mexican editors in certain circles, and they don't want to play this up, perhaps.
Well, when you talk about the Cifuentes, the Colombian, Alex Cifuentes, whose testimony we're talking about, which has stunned the courtroom in New York City, and with this allegation that El Chapo paid Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto $100 million back in 2012 and during the transition, just before he became a president. Now, Cifuentes has described himself as Chapo Guzman's right-hand man, or his left-hand man, he says. That's a joke, I guess. You're in Colombia now, in the very region where all this cocaine is grown. What do you know about this guy, and is he that important in terms of the hierarchy in drug trafficking in Mexico?
It's very hard to be sure about the hierarchy of a lot of these guys. It's very hard to get really concrete evidence. What we do know about him from his statements and the statements that have come out is that he was spending a lot of time in Mexico with Chapo. So you had various Colombians who were based in Mexico and working as major connections between the Colombian cartels and the Mexican traffickers. Now, when you look at the relationship between the Mexicans and the Colombians, the two nations in Latin America with the most powerful drug traffickers, you see this gradual shift of power to the Mexicans over the decades. So everyone remembers Pablo Escobar back in 93 as the most powerful drug trafficker in the world, and now we're talking about Chapo Guzman, a Mexican. And the deal was that originally the Colombians would take the cocaine right over the Caribbean from here into the United States, fly it right over into Florida. After the U.S. cracked down on that trafficking route by using the U.S. Navy, radar, and various things, and managed to bust a lot of that cocaine, the Colombians turned to Mexico, and they began by paying them off at a certain price, you know, per kilo. A kilo of cocaine here costs about $2,000. You also heard it during the trial in New York, some tape in which Chapo Guzman was negotiating, in fact, the price of a kilo of cocaine for $2,000, and the Colombian wanted them to pay $2,100 per kilo. Obviously, when you talk about tons, it all adds up to a lot of money. So it's about 2,000 kilos. Dollars per kilo here, but originally the Colombians would pay the Mexicans to carry it through. But the Mexicans gradually became more powerful and ended up just buying the cocaine off the Colombians and taking it into the United States. So the Mexican cartels became very powerful. It's kind of odd in a sense to have a Colombian who became so powerful in a Mexican cartel in Mexico. That's kind of strange. But that's what's being said in the testimony.
Well, he did live up in the mountains for a couple of years with El Chapo, did he not? Cifuentes.
Yeah, exactly. That's what they're saying. And this is the area which I've been to. I was there last year in those mountains where I met Chapo's mother and his cousin, and went to a church which apparently he would go into when he was on the run. Saw the house apparently that Chapo stayed in when he was on the run, just above his village. And it's quite a crazy environment. It's these are a kind of mountain people that have lived up there for generations. The closest thing in America, I think, would be the hillbillies of the Appalachian Mountains. I mean, people, your communities, right up, very far up, with kind of dirt roads. It's kind of strange to imagine a foreigner, being a Colombian, albeit in a similar culture, but a foreigner up there with Chapo and gaining influence in this very complicated structure. But then again, this connection to the Colombian cartels themselves could be very important. So, if you have the right connections and you go down to make the deal, a lot of the deals are made in Panama, where a lot of the changeover is made, where the Colombians will deliver the cocaine up to Panama, the Mexicans will provide the money there, and then from Panama, the Mexicans will take it up through Central America, through Mexico and into the United States.
And again, I'm speaking with Joan Grillo, who has reported on Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time magazine, Reuters, CNN, the Associated Press, and the PBS NewsHour. His book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. And his latest book is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. So earlier in the trial of El Chapo Guzman in New York, one of the witnesses, I think it was a bookkeeper, said that they had a $1 million a month outlay of bribes for local officials. So given the allegation that Peña Nieto asked for a $250 million bribe and settled for a $100 million bribe from El Chapo, and that we've already heard earlier testimony from an accountant, I think, saying that the monthly expenses were $1 million. That's at $12 million a year. That seems pretty low. So what explains the gap between those two figures? And there's an awful lot of missing money there. If you pay the local people off to the tune of $1 million a month, then you pay the head of this country off to the tune of $100 million. It sounds like you're also paying off a bunch of people in the middle.
Sure. I mean, it's very hard to make sense of a lot of these things that have come out. And my first reaction when I did hear the $100 million bribe, it does sound high, even for a president. I mean, people do live in, you know, the rich of Mexico. There are, you know, various billionaires in Mexico and people living in these huge, you know, in this kind of different world, different level of zeros than we're used to. And people can see that, you know, the big Mexican president is the best business in the country. You can make a lot of money. And that politicians often have had that attitude. Even so, $100 million, you know, it's hard to know, was that a bribe for the presidency, supposedly, for his six-year term? Or what was it? Does seem a very large amount. And one thing that's hard to make sense of is where the money does go with drug trafficking. And you see, you know, when you add up and there's a lot of money there, I mean, you look at how many people take cocaine in the United States, how many, you know, you try and guess how many people take cocaine in the United States. I think that it might pay $150 for a gram. You add all that up and, you know, you get the billions and billions of dollars that go down. But then again, you know, going up to Chapo's village, seeing his mother's house, seeing his family's houses, they're rich by the standards of a very poor area, but they're not super luxurious. They don't look like the houses of people linked to a billion-dollar organization. Even some of the, you know, some of these houses of Chapo we might not have seen yet. People have been talking about these things. But it seems we can't really see these super luxurious things. So again, you know, maybe there is that money there, maybe there isn't. You know, in terms of the mix of bribes, I mean, you know, people can move on extremely different levels. So you could say that, you know, local officials can be police commanders and, you know, local generals or these people, you might be happy, give them $100,000, give them a couple of $100,000. But when you get to somebody who is at the highest level of the country, it just becomes a whole different world in terms of payments.
So has anybody been able to do a kind of roadmap of the bribes, who they go to, what happens once you pay the money? If, for example, it's true that Peña took $100 million back in 2012, just before he went into office during the transition, that presumably Guzman would have wanted value for money, and he'd want to basically make sure that the Mexican law enforcement authorities didn't catch him or didn't interdict him or didn't interfere in any way with the flow of drugs into the United States. How in a country where it does seem like corruption is endemic, how do you guarantee that you're going to get value for money if you're bribing government officials?
Well, yeah, that's very hard to do. I think a lot of the time the violence against officials in Mexico is connected precisely to that. You get officials who are targeted, and then you get sometimes the drug traffickers leave messages saying you took our money and then you betrayed us. So there's that thing, like, you know, have they don't really deliver, or they don't deliver as much as the drug cartel wants, and then they get angry and they attack them and say, well, we definitely have every right to attack this official because he took our money and then he betrayed us, then he arrested one of our guys. Now, obviously, the reality was that Chapo Guzman was arrested under Peña Nieto, well, escaped prison under Peña Nieto, and then was rearrested under Peña Nieto. So it's hard to know really what the story there was. Now, there could still be one theory, which I heard, is that when the Marines, the Mexican Marines, which are kind of an elite force inside the Mexican security forces, when they first arrested Chapo in 2014, it was an operation not even Peña Nieto knew about. So they were kind of doing this themselves. They're quite close to the U.S. security forces. They were getting information from the U.S., and they were deliberately shielding this from the high levels of government because precisely that it could be filtered. So Peña Nieto, after he was informed and then declared, oh, yeah, we caught Chapo Guzman, but it wasn't really his operation. Then the prison escape, I mean, we could look, you know, he escaped from what's supposed to be the top security prison in Mexico. How much corruption was there involved in that? I mean, there was obviously corruption, but how much, at what level that came from? And then the rearrest adds even more things. So a real labyrinth to try and make sense of. And really, to be honest, no one really knows the whole solution, as a friend of mine says. If you know what's going on in Mexico, you're misinformed. So right. That's the kind of labyrinth you get in Mexican politics.
Well, but the second time after he was jailed and he had that dramatic escape, and obviously I think you're pointing to the real likelihood that there was some corruption. You don't get out of a maximum security prison without some help. But then the second time the final time he got nabbed was because a Mexican actress, along with Sean Penn, the American actor, had visited him. And that seemed to really irritate the Mexican authorities. And I believe the Mexican actress is now living here in Los Angeles. She doesn't feel safe returning to Mexico. So what happened there? Do you think that was a sort of accident, that maybe Peña Nieto and company didn't really want to arrest him, but they were forced to because of the publicity, because of these actors going, doing interviews with him, I think for Rolling Stone.
Yeah, that's a funny, crazy part of this story. So you had the meeting with Kate Castillo and Sean Penn in the mountains of Sinaloa. And actually, you know, after that meeting, and it seemed that they could have been followed by elements of the Mexican security forces. Now, this time this was still not known to the public. So it wasn't like a public embarrassment or anything at this point. That it could have been a bit of a public embarrassment. It would have been a public embarrassment if it would have come out while, you know, the security forces couldn't catch him, but Sean Penn's there meeting him. But it hadn't actually come out there yet. So they could have been infiltrated by security force in some ways, and shortly after the meeting, short term after the meeting, within a time of a few days, there was an attempt to capture El Chapo by the Mexican Marines again. Now, he actually escaped that attempt, but then he went down and hid in the city of Mochis, Sinaloa, and then later in January was captured. And then right after his capture, Rolling Stone put out their story. Kate de Castillo was angry with Sean Penn and angry with the way, you know, she thought that he was quite devious in his motivations. And actually, she did come back to Mexico recently after the Peña Nieto government finished, right, as the government changed. She came back and she said, she kind of, in a press conference, she said she'd basically signaled she'd like to give Sean Penn a knee in the balls, in between his legs. Was something she signaled. So, but that's a bit of a distraction, I feel, in some ways, to the real core issue here, is the kind of weird merging between show business and high-level organized crime perhaps distracts from the kind of real issues that face millions of Mexicans in this violence. And, you know, this kind of crazy story of Chapo, we can't forget the insane human cost there's been here. I mean, well over 100,000 people have been murdered in the last decade in the violence connected to the drug cartels, the security forces fighting them, and self-defense groups and so forth.
Right. Well, just in closing, Peña Nieto, it was under Peña Nieto that Guzman, El Chapo, was extradited to the United States. And clearly there were resistance within Mexico to extradite him, perhaps for the reasons that we're talking about. But it did happen under Peña Nieto, right, the extradition.
Yeah, it did. And so, you know, it's interesting as well. I mean, people always ask this question, you know, they wouldn't, you know, would they really want to let him go because he could talk and name names. It's not actually him naming names right now, it's other people in the trial. And this is so far the witnesses of the prosecution. So what's kind of crazy is this is the prosecution case against El Chapo. And it's exposing this crazy corruption in Mexico or bringing up these crazy allegations. We haven't seen the defense yet. And, you know, I had a piece recently in the New York Times. I called it El Chapo Puts the War on Drugs on Trial. You know, it's very interesting that El Chapo asked for a court case. Most drug traffickers, when they're extradited to the United States, make a deal. He wanted a court case. He said, I don't know if he really wants to prove himself guilty or he just wants to put on this crazy show for the world. And in this court case, it's kind of showing a lot of the insanity of the war on drugs and this issue. I mean, you've got, you know, this Mexican establishment we're looking at it being so corrupt was supported by the United States with billions of dollars under the Merida Initiative to try and fight drug cartels. And then, you know, who knows what we're going to see in the defense. I think in the defense, we're going to see a lot about the tactics used by DEA agents. Now, the prosecution is trying to suppress this. The defense is trying to bring this up. Well, then what we're going to do is bring up some of the very questionable tactics of American agents themselves in the war on drugs. And let's see if we see any of that before this is over.
Well, Joan Grillo, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
As always, great to be here.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Joan Grillo, who has reported on Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time magazine, Reuters, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, and his book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and his latest book is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, the headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.